Today's Fretboard Journal podcast is brought to you by our friends over at Dying Breed Music. Lane over at Dying Breed specializes in the golden era vintage guitars that you read about in the Fretboard Journal, really. The Martins, the Gibsons, the other brands that are so coveted by collectors. And he has a bunch of great ones available right now, including a 1934 Martin 00018. That's a long scale guitar with all original, including the original bridge, the original bridge plate, the original finish, tuners, you name it. That one has been set up by John Arnold, who is definitely no slouch in the setup department and is ready to go. He also has a 1941 Gibson J35 with all original parts minus the tuner buttons and the bridge pins, so basically all original. And a 1939 Martin 00021 that is all original and crack-free and looks just about perfect. You can reach out to Lane at 870-818-34 if you ever have any questions about his inventory or if you want to hear about his consignment program. His website is dyingbreedguitars.com. And if you do reach out to him, tell him the Fretboard Journal sent you. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine, and that is John Rauhaus playing in the background as always. He is on tour with Nico Case right now on the East Coast. I hope some of you will go and check them out and maybe say hi to John for us. As always, we interview some of our favorite guitar makers, guitar players, and guitar historians on this podcast, and today is definitely no different. I'm talking to Ernie Bailey of Wire Instruments. If you don't know about Ernie, he is one of those rare and cool electric guitar builders who is thankfully not just copying Gibson and Fender shapes and doing the no-brainer thing. He's kind of inspired by the touch guitars of Dave Bunker and weird European and Japanese guitars from the 60s and 70s and all sorts of offbeat stuff. And his Wire Instruments look like absolutely nothing else. Check them out. He's on Instagram as well as, of course, he has a website. Ernie and I are pals. We had just gone to the Jawbreaker reunion show down in Olympia, Washington, right before this podcast. And I heard so many great stories on that road trip down there. I wanted to share a few of them for posterity here on the podcast. So I dragged him in here and we did the podcast. And I hope you like it. It's been an insanely busy week around here at the Fretboard Journal, which is why this podcast is a couple of days late. Suzanne Santa was just here. I just interviewed Bruce Coburn. Hot Rise were just here. We crammed them into our office. All of these things are going to be future podcasts as well as future videos on fretboardjournal.com. So I hope you enjoy them. And in a few days, I'm headed down to Southern California for the NAMM show. If any of you guys are going to be there, reach out to me. I'd love to meet some of you. It's going to be kind of frantic, but it's always good to see the listeners of the Fretboard Journal podcast. And if you're not going to be down there, by all means, follow us on our Instagram page, which is just Fretboard Journal. Because I'm going to be posting anything and everything I see that looks cool down there. And so it'll be a great way to stay connected and see what all the hubbub is about. I'll probably find some offbeat things that some of the other publications won't, and you might enjoy those. Beyond all that stuff, we're winding down our, I guess you could call it subscription drive, but right now we are offering for $99, you can get 12 issues or 3 years of the Fretboard Journal. This is our lowest price ever. That offer expires on January 23rd and at midnight Pacific. And a lot of folks have been getting it. The phone's been ringing off the hook. If you'd like to get it, just go to fretboardjournal.com and click on the shop button and you will find it. And if you use the coupon code podcast, you save $5 off that $99 because you've had to listen to my voice over all these years, and that ought to be worth something. The reason we're doing this subscription drive is to get as many new subscribers as we can because we're about to raise our subscription rates by a couple of bucks. As you may know, the USPS just raised their postage rates, and when you're shipping over 100,000 copies of a magazine every year, those postage rates add up, believe it or not. So we don't want to break the bank and kill ourselves here, so we're having to add a little bit to our subscription rates, but it won't hurt you guys, we promise. And the quality of the Fretboard Journal isn't going anywhere. All right, without further ado, here is my talk with Ernie Bailey of Wire Instruments. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you will check out his work. And as always, thanks everybody for listening. If you enjoy the Fretboard Journal podcast, go leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you subscribe to it. How's it going, Ernie?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good.
All right.
So you regaled me with stories on the way to the Jawbreaker show yesterday of life with Nirvana, being a guitar tech. But how did this all start for you? You grew up in the Spokane area?
I guess that all sort of started around a time when I was living in Pullman, Washington, and even more so like out in the country about 5 miles, really like out in the wheat fields.
Yeah. And what you were, you just became a guitarist and got the guitar bug out there?
Yeah, I think I was listening to a lot of American Top 40, you know, just pop radio, and really kind of interested in music in general. And then hitting kind of the early teens, you start getting into like guitar bands. Mm-hmm. And then around that time, you know, like in high school, you've got friends who are actually playing guitar. And I had one friend who was extremely good, like not, you know, like what you'd expect for, you know, somebody, a player of that age. And with that, he showed me a Stratocaster that he had just bought. And I think that was kind of where everything really started moving, because I was building a lot of like plastic monster models and stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Up until that point. And so this was just kind of this weird crossroads where it's like you're getting this interest in music and guitar. Then you actually saw an electric guitar in person. And I was just so fascinated by how it was modular and just kind of marveled, you know, at its construction. And it also was this object. It was this thing that I guess a person had to have in order to,
yeah,
to be an entertainer, or to, you know, to sort of complete the puzzle. So,
so what was, I have to imagine there weren't a ton of guitar stores in that region at that point.
No, there was one in downtown Pullman. And it's funny because every electric guitar they had in there was a, you know, it was a mid-70s Fender, maple neck, white finish, and a black pickguard. And so I still build guitars with that color configuration today, because that was my first impression of, you know, the electric guitar. It was a, you know, yeah, like my friend Glenn, his Strat was a, I think it was a 74, you know, that was white with a black guard and a maple board.
Why on earth was that? That was just the owner's taste?
I think the owner just loved that, and so he ordered nothing but that. That was my thing. I went into the store and just saw like 5 or 6 of them hanging there.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And then did you join a band shortly thereafter taking the guitar? Or?
No. See, from there, I think I let them know that I wanted to buy a guitar. And I had a couple friends at school, and one of them had located a 77 Ibanez Explorer, which is called the Destroyer.
Okay.
And that was, I think, like right up my alley. I really like the futuristic,
uh-huh,
you know, kind of wild stuff. And so, but I had a little problem. I didn't have any money.
Mm-hmm.
And, but I had all these models that I had built. So my mom had actually struck a deal with her sister to see if I was really serious about this, that her sister would buy all my models for $200.
Wow.
And so I sold like literally everything I owned to get this $200 to go buy my first guitar. And and just really like never looked back. So
what did your sister do with the models, or her sister?
She gave them to her kids. Okay. You know, and when I went over to their house, it's like, sure enough, they were all over the yard, you know, like
all your works of art.
Yeah,
just destroyed,
chewed up by the dogs. And so it was definitely an exercise in like letting go of your past.
Mm-hmm. So. And then you were in bands, I take it? Or?
Yeah, a few. You know, I kind of found that I got so busy actually working on guitars. So I took that guitar and took it home, and I realized pretty quick that it was going to be a long road to be the kind of player that my friend was.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because there was not really so much to do out there where we lived, I used to take things apart and fix things and build things. So I really like set out just dismantling my guitar. Even without a soldering iron, I had used my brother's wood burning kit to actually heat up the connections to get the pickups out. And I laid everything out super methodically and photographed it, and was just really fascinated by this thing. And I put it all back together and started adjusting things, like, you know, let's put the bridge right here and see, get those strings down a little bit closer. And the tuners are a little tight. Like, why don't we kind of adjust those to where they're a little more comfortable?
Uh-huh.
So I kind of went through the whole guitar and set it all up like that. And when I got it all back together, I took it back to school because I was kind of excited that it played really easy. So I let my guitar player friends play it, and they were really you know, thrilled. And I kind of told them what I'd done. At first they were like, well, really? You know? And so I showed them the photographs of this dismantled guitar and they were like, whoa. You know, so
yeah,
they started to give me their Les Pauls and Strats and whatever guitar they had to see if I could actually make it play better. And in one case, I had a friend who had a guitar that wasn't making any sound. So he asked me if, you know, I might be able to actually fix it. And I said, sure, you know, I'll take a look at it. And I got it home and took the pickguard off and I found one broken wire, you know, and it was just that simple. And so you fix it, take it back to school, and then suddenly you have a reputation as the guitar repairman. And so that more or less like started the ball rolling. And if you actually got to things that were maybe beyond your ability, I'd go to the public library and read guitar player articles on guitar repair, or I would get on the Greyhound bus and head up to Spokane and hang out they had like actual repair shops up there. And so I would kind of linger all day and nag them and ask them a ton of questions and made some great friends there. Actually one is my friend John Sabo, who works over at
Dusty Strings.
And he's the one who ultimately kind of, took me on board like as an apprentice in a repair shop and taught me, you know, how to really, really, you know, work on guitars. And at that time too, he was also sending me home to Pullman with these bags and bags of guitar parts, because this was the heyday of like, taking all your hardware off your guitar and putting brass on there, or putting DiMarzio pickups in. Yeah. So they would, you know, send me home with all these, you know, obsolete or parts that were deemed as like, you know, junk.
Yeah.
And so I started making guitars in wood shop out of these leftover parts.
Wow. And were you still using the wood burning kit for your soldering?
Must have gone to Radio Shack at some point, invested in a real iron.
Yeah. So. Were you getting acoustic guitars too, or was it mainly electric guitars your friends wanted you to fix up?
Primarily electrics. There were some acoustics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you figured that out too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Amazing. So then when you had a store at some point?
So I started working. There was a repair shop in a music store in Spokane where John and I worked. And so I worked there for, I guess, a number of years. And then, you know, started developing a shop at home, like in the basement, having, you know, your own repair shop.
This was like, instead of college, you just went straight into it? Or?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I actually went to college and studied graphic design and visual media and got a degree in that. And in the final weeks of the program, they started taking us around to the places where we'd be working. And I remember walking into these rooms where people were sort of hunched over and doing cut and paste, you know, like the steak ads for Safeway and stuff. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, like I can't stop repairing guitars. And I didn't really fully comprehend the reality of like where that work would lead to at the time. This was kind of before computers and computer graphics. So, I enjoyed doing the guitar repair and working in a store and was making good money. It was around the time that, like the Floyd Rose Tremolo came around. And that was a pretty involved repair. And so, you know, there were a lot of guitars that were getting modified at that time for that. So I think that I, you know, felt like I was probably making comparable money than as to what I would with a degree. So I decided just to stick with guitars.
Ignore the steak ads.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what was your first kind of guitar tech job?
I dreamed about being a guitar tech for years, and I was apprehensive because I thought that, you know, you really must, how do you ever really, like, really reach that level to where you can be around big bands and, you know, professional touring things. Mm-hmm. I just didn't quite, I just had different ideas about, you know, what that was really about. And so When Nirvana had hit it big, I had been familiar with them through a mutual friend, and we would go out and see them actually when they were a pretty small group. And then I think it was in early 92, the bass player had moved into the neighborhood I was living in, and we'd struck up a conversation. I had a vegetarian cafe in Green Lake at around that time.
Okay. So you moved to Seattle.
I was living in Seattle at that point.
Okay.
And so I ran into Chris and we were talking about their guitars, and, you know, I just asked him who was fixing all their stuff. And he said, we don't really have a guitar tech right now, and I've dropped off a lot of stuff around town, and I'm not really getting called back, and the stuff's not getting fixed. And I thought, wow, there's, I would love to drive around and swoop this stuff up. And if anything, I can at least say, you know, hey, I've worked, you know, repaired guitars for these guys. And that's being a fan of the band. That was,
But how did you go? So what made you start a vegetarian cafe? That was a whole nother chapter.
Yeah. So I guess in getting out of Spokane and getting to Seattle, there was a point where a lot of the repair work had dried up in Spokane.
Okay.
And so, and around that time I had one customer, named Tony Ramo, who was a bass player, and he was, running the espresso bar for Nordstrom downtown. We had, like, it was a very new thing at the time, like to actually have an espresso cart out on the street. And it was a pretty cool place for, I hung out like with a lot of the punk rockers and stuff and the new wave kids. And we would go down and hang out at this espresso stand, you know,
in a department store or in front of a department store. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like, you know, for living in Spokane, it was like your connection to you know, feeling like maybe you had actually left the country. And, and so, so he was going inside to sell shoes, and he was asked to find somebody to actually run the espresso bar. And he came into my shop one day, and he said, hey, he said, I was asked to find somebody to run this shop. And he said, you're like the only person who really came to mind because you're kind of detail oriented, and is wondering if you might want to, you know, come work for the store. And I said, well, I'd kind of burn out on, you know, doing this, and you're hearing, like, you know, you're working in a store where you're hearing people playing, you know, Crazy Train all day long and bad guitar and stuff. And, you know, it's kind of like, be careful of, like, you know, taking that job that's like your dream job. And so for whatever reason, I decided to accept the job, and I'd never actually even drank a cup of coffee at that point. So I was hired to manage their espresso bar.
All right.
And so after a couple of years, the bar was doing really well, and so I was offered to a job managing like the downtown Seattle espresso bar, which later turned into like a corporate job.
Okay.
And so with that, you know, it's like, it seemed like after a few years, it's like, well, how did I wind up, you know, like doing this? I took a job, and now I've got this job where I'm like traveling a lot, and, you know, you're working a lot, and so I decided that maybe it would be a lot easier if I just opened my own place up on Green Lake.
Okay.
So that's kind of how that place came about.
And this was the era when you could still do that in Seattle. It wasn't super cost prohibitive, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so,
were you a chef too, or were you coming up with the menu and everything?
No, it was, you know, it was pretty simple fare, you know, like soup and sandwiches and things like that. Some baking involved.
Yeah.
And
And were you still dabbling in guitars while you were kind of immersed in the food service industry? Or?
Yeah, you know, I always kept a repair shop in my house because I liked going out and finding, you know, guitars that needed work and fixing them up and, you know, keeping your chops up with that. So, and occasionally building stuff. So, yeah, and just staying really busy in general. You know, I just love to work on things.
Yeah, and so when Chris, were you able to chase down all of his guitars that were scattered around Seattle?
Yeah, so he made me a list of all the stuff and where it was at. So I drove around all these places and said, hey, I'm here to get it. You know, I don't know if you've had a chance to work on it yet, but I'm going to, you know, I said I'd pick it up. And so I rounded up all this stuff and stayed up like probably all night working on it and just fixing everything, power amps, guitars, and, you know.
Just everything that was scattered around?
Everything that was busted. So, and then the next day, drove over and knocked on his door with a station wagon full of, you know, fixed gear. And he was just kind of like, wow, you know. So we started hanging out and going to shows and doing things. And then just, I think one day we were going across the Fremont Bridge driving in his Volkswagen. And he turned to me and said, hey, man, how about it? You know, I was like, how about what? You know, he said, well, how about you? You go on the road with us and, you know, work with us as our technician. I said, sure. You know, I can't really say no to this because it was,
dang.
Yeah.
And then did you have to close down your restaurant or?
No, we kept it open and just sort of, you know, made it work. I mean, in Nirvana, I actually wasn't really touring a lot at that point. You know, they're doing like a lot of TV shows and one-offs and stuff. And so, and I was actually working for the, and that was at a point where they really had sort of screeched to a halt with touring. So it was nice because I could, you know, while in Seattle, go through and kind of revamp almost their entire back line and go through and rework all the guitars. And so it was a chance kind of for them to catch their breath and yeah, just make a lot of improvements that they needed. And they actually were like starting to make enough money to where they could buy speakers that work and cables that worked and things like that. So a lot of the problems that had plagued them in the past of, you know, guitars shorting out, it's like those were now no longer.
And did Kurt and Chris have like particular setups they were asking for or quirks that they wanted in every guitar or?
No, you know, I think that they were really open-minded to ideas and things like, and suggestions, you know, like you might suggest like, well, hey, what if we tried some of these amps or, I mean, there was one point I think where, you know, Chris was talking about wanting a high watt because of a friend of his was playing a high watt. So we found that and then, you know, we had to incorporate that into his bass, you know, system, which is still, there's a lot of rack gear and trying to get a single high watt head to power, you know, 8 cabs or whatever.
Wow.
So it was a lot of just making ideas work.
Yeah, I imagine, you know, a typical band being a guitar tech is pretty mundane. It's like the same stuff happens again and again and again. I would have to imagine with those guys being so hard on their gear, like you were being thrown everything under the sun to work on. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Yeah, I love fixing up stuff so much that it was sort of like I was very happy to have lots to do. So, to have all this stuff and to be able to make it work again. And then also, you know, I had a fascination with weird obsolete pedals and gear and things like that. And kind of a knowledge of what things did. And so I really felt like really useful because most artists I was working with at that point, they were just really into like the latest and the newest stuff. And Nirvana were just the opposite. Like they liked this weird kind of kitschy, you know, strange pawn shop gear and stuff like that. And I was all about that stuff. I knew all about the history of the companies and, and so, you know, just with similar tastes, it was just kind of a great fit. Like you feel like you're well-versed in all this stuff that they're really fascinated with, do old solid-state transistor amps and stuff, which nobody had an interest, or for the most part, most people didn't.
And were you, I mean, now you're kind of considered an authority on their gear, and people turn to you when somebody says, was this really Kurt Cobain's? But were they kind of having you go buy stuff for them? Like, were they saying, like, hey, I want to find this amp. Can you go get it for us? Or
yeah, I think that they knew that I was just looking for stuff in general.
Yeah.
Anyway, and that I enjoyed doing it. And I know, you know, like Kurt definitely did not like going to music stores and things like that. David did.
Yeah.
And I think Chris enjoyed it, but I think they knew that like if they wanted something that I would go out and find something, it would come back and it would be working, and there wouldn't be any, you know, like.
Yeah,
like broken headstocks or whatever, you know. It's like just let him do it.
Yeah.
So,
and then after the Nirvana chapter, what did you end up doing? Were you still teching for other bands or?
So after Nirvana, so I was doing the restaurant, and you know it was difficult because, you know, we'd experienced something with the end of Nirvana that was traumatic and it was very tragic. And with the loss of a public figure, it's very different from, like, say, if you lose somebody, it's a very private,
sure,
you know, thing. And so, you know, with the restaurant, a lot of the customers and your friends, they know, you know, that you had worked for this group.
Yeah.
And so you had like this steady stream of people coming in the door every day saying like, hey, man, I'm so sorry. And you know, it's not like when if you experience a loss of somebody, you really have a lot of control in how you dole out that grieving.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really tricky, like, you know, working there, like in the next year and just having to talk about this, like every single day to people. And so I think it was after about a year we decided to sell the restaurant because the numbers were good, and I think we were just kind of exhausted and decided the time was right. And so after the restaurant sold, I remember thinking, I'm going to take like 3 months off. I've been working since I was like 14, it seems like, and and rarely have ever taken a break. And like 3 days later, the phone rang and it was Dave, and he said, we're going to do like a van tour with this new group I have called Foo Fighters. We're going to be opening for Mike Watt. He says, you want to jump in and like guitar tech for it? And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
That sounds like a blast. And it was such a great escape from Seattle and, the kind of the gloom that we were experiencing and just getting out on the road and in a van with a bunch of people that you didn't know. Half the van were Nirvana people. It was Pat, David, and myself, and then the other half was like Sunny Day Real Estate people, which I hadn't met yet, so it was like you're making a lot of friends, and it was kind of like going out on like this crazy camping trip, for the next month, and with a new project, we're out playing, and what was so cool about that was that, the Foo Fighters hadn't had an album out yet, and nobody really knew anything about them, so the people coming to the clubs, and we were playing like little bars and tiny theaters and stuff. And so it was funny that like the people attending those shows were people who really took chances with music. Like they wanted to see what this new thing was all about. Mm-hmm. Never heard, any of the music. And so it was a very healthy and very fun environment for everybody.
And as a guitar tech, was that a relatively easy tour? Or?
It was a blast. I thought it was.
How long did your Foo Fighters work went on for a while, right?
Yeah, I think 4 to 5 years.
Okay.
I believe. And they toured a lot. I mean, that was a group where sometimes you'd leave the front door and you'd come home like 3 months later. Yeah. Like they were very aggressive with the touring and it was a lot of fun, but it did take a lot out of you after a while. There was a point I think where you felt like we're just living in airports and megacities,
but you went from the Econoline van and the bar tour to where were they at the end, like giant stadiums?
I think pretty close to that. We were playing some stadiums, but also large theaters. I think
so
a little bit of both.
But pretty cool to be able to just see that that transition.
Yeah, headlining festivals by that point, I'd say. So
yeah. Yeah. And then did you burn out on that, or you just kind of...
No, I think, so I was married and we were talking about, I guess we were prolonging starting a family. So I think it was one of those things that you felt like the time was right to maybe stop the road you don't want to wait too long.
So for folks, a lot of builders and amateur builders listen to the show, and I bet a lot of people aspire to maybe be guitar techs. Like, what are the markings of a good guitar tech beyond just knowing the gear?
Let's see. Well, I think you have to be easy to live with, and it was funny because like when I first started out, I remember thinking that they would. The other guitar techs, when I got out there, were going to be so seasoned and like these really like elite level, repair people. And I got out there and quickly kind of discovered that, I'd already had a background like 10 years in having a repair shop. And I quickly found out that that wasn't really the norm out there. And so like after a few weeks of working with Nirvana, I started having people come up to me backstage who worked for other bands and maybe other guitar techs. And they would say, hey, I heard you're the guitar tech for Nirvana. And I was like, yeah. And they said, well, I heard that like you can fix their cars and you can fix like toasters and you can fix, stereos and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, yeah. And they're like, wow, that's really weird. And then they would ask you like, well, how do you put on strings and stuff like that? Like, what do you do? And things that were like...
Basic.
So I think, to answer your question, having a strong background in repair is great. And packing a adequate set of tools, that's something that's going to get you through, 90% of the jobs you're going to face out there. So
did you, did you pretty much have your toolkit dialed in by at an early stage in this whole thing, or?
Well, I think you start out by bringing too much, and then you realize, like, after a tour, okay, well, I never touched that, I never used that.
Got
so
it.
You begin to streamline it, because you'd have to carry that thing through airports and,
yeah,
and room to room and stuff. So.
And how fast are you at changing strings?
I don't know.
Should we time you?
Yeah, we could. Changed a few of them.
So when did wire instruments kind of come to be?
That was just a little over 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was the thought behind that, and what were you aiming to do?
I think that I was thinking a bit about, you know, how much time you'd spent in your life doing this, and how repair work is really fun, but in a way it's kind of invisible. Like when you're doing repairs and restoration, you're ultimately just kind of getting something up and running or back to its original state, and which is great and it's very satisfying. But I was just thinking a lot about how when I was a kid, in like the mid 70s, it was a really exciting time. Like you'd open up Guitar Player magazine and you'd see like guitars you'd never seen before. And they were pretty radical and ultimately kind of timeless. You know, a lot of stuff was emerging around that time, like the early BC Riches and the Travis Beans. And, and there was a lot of just kind of cool stuff happening. And I remember thinking that for some reason, I haven't seen anything in a while that I was really very excited about. And realize that, well, it's just you. You know, you're probably just maybe a tougher critic, and maybe you should actually do something about that. Like, maybe you should put the pen to the page and start drawing and you know, see if you come up with some ideas that you want to build and you feel like they, you know, like there's a reason to do it. And so I think it was a combination of those two things. You felt like, well, you've got all this knowledge and experience and those kind of tendencies or feelings to want to build something. And also, too, it to me seemed like this thing. It's like ultimately, it's kind of like this identifier. Like you've devoted so much of your life to this, like to actually make something that's tangible that you can kind of show to people. Like, hey, this is what I do. You know,
yeah.
It's like you can hold up a guitar and say, "This is kind of like this is what I spent my life doing." So, you know, it's
yeah.
Hopefully, I don't have to explain anymore. It's like, you know, this is. It took a long time to learn how to do this, and here's what I have to show for it.
So. Yeah. Were there other boutique makers or luthiers who you're kind of like, I like this guy's model. I like what he's doing with his life? Or
yeah, quite a few.
Quite a few?
Yeah.
Who were some of the main ones?
I think around the time that I started Wire, I was watching James Trossard a lot and really liking what he was doing.
Sure.
And Uli Teufel a lot with his Birdfish was so cool. And I remember, you know, like seeing that and just thinking like, wow, the sky is kind of the limit. Like you can honestly, you know, do whatever you want. And why not come out of the gates with something really radical?
Yeah. And what was that first? What were those first guitars like?
For me, the first model was the Sleepwalker. And it was inspired by two guitars I remember from the 70s. And one of them was, there was a local builder here named Dave Bunker, and he had a guitar called the Sunstar, which was also later renamed the Astral. And it was essentially like this H-shape design, very, very strange and science fiction, kind of like a very, it would almost make you think of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And then there was another guy in New York in the 70s who built a guitar that John Lennon had, which I don't think that anybody knew at the time that Lennon had, because there wasn't really a lot of footage or photographs of him with his around that time. But I remember seeing Tom Snyder staying up late and watching The Late Show, and the Plasmatics were on there once. And their guitar player named Wes Beach came out with this guitar. It was called the Sardonyx, and it was this weird H-shaped thing again.
Yeah.
And I remember just being sort of, like, this was always on my mind, like this weird sort of Stanley Kubrick 2001 inspired, like, weird guitar. And so I'd always wanted to kind of do something with that. And for years, I'd actually wanted to acquire a Sardonyx, but they only made 25 of them, and they were so rare and almost impossible to find. And so around this time, I was like thinking about the first guitar I was going to build. One turned up on eBay, and I thought, oh, cool, you know, I can actually like reel it in.
Yeah,
it was hovering like around $600 or so, and I thought, okay, you know, that sounds right. And you're actually seeing photographs of one, you know, that were really clear, and so anyway, like the bidding ran up to like around $3,000, and I was like, like, well, judging by the photographs, like, I don't know that I really like it that much. Like, it looked really cool, you know, on a,
from 10 feet away.
Yeah, yeah. Or like on TV footage, you know, from 30 years ago. So I remember thinking, you know, feeling like, well, okay, you didn't win the auction, but you could build something like that that maybe is a lot nicer.
Yeah.
You know, like you could actually do some cool stuff with it that incorporates a little bit of like Danish modern design, you know, with like the colors of, you know, like with a lot of Danish modern design, there were like bright colors that were married with exotic hardwoods and things that I hadn't really seen done in the guitar world. So, so all the stuff was kind of happening around that time. I thought I should do like a sort of a space age guitar, but try to do things that have like not really been done with it stylistically. So
the Danish modern thing I hadn't thought of, but it makes total sense thinking about that guitar. How did you make, I mean, did you cut it out in foam or how do you go through the prototyping process of something like that? Because
I think that I started off with, like it must've been quarter inch MDF, you know, or Masonite, you know, like cutting out these pieces, which ultimately serve as like your templates for routing and you know, forming the pieces. So with that, and really just letting, you know, like going out to the garage and kicking over the table saw and just start pushing wood through and working with angles and shapes. And
that's got some metal in it too, though, right?
Yeah. So that had a...
Do you have a lathe or what were you doing with
that? No, with that, you know, the first back I built out of the Masonite, and around that time I'd struck up a friendship with Kevin Burkett, who has a company in Pensacola, Florida called the Electrical Guitar Company. And he and I were both... I guess you want to say almost like scholars of the Travis Bean. Like we had studied and collected and like, you know, like tried to find out like all the information about this company because we were deeply fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And once we sort of located each other on the internet, we became kind of fast friends. And so he was making guitars out of all metal. And so, so when I started thinking about, you know, I'd like to have maybe a major metal component on this guitar, I just simply asked him, I said, hey, would you be game for cutting this out if I send you, you know,
yeah,
you know what I want? And he was like, yeah, sure. So it was like our first collaboration together. And so he cut out the back plates for those and we're getting them back here and polishing them. And,
And they fit? Dialed in?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was cool.
And how many of those have you made?
I think there were close to 30. It was intended to be, I think, a run of 25. I kind of wanted to follow, you know, like a little bit of history repeating with the sardonyx.
Because and then just be done? Never make them again?
Yeah. Okay. I actually wanted to do that and then five basses. And then I wound up, I think, going a little bit farther, like making closer to 30 or maybe 27 of them. I know that I still have two of the back plates at home and one or two bodies that are sort of in process that I'm actually like working now on wrapping those up, whereas the initial ones I built maybe, you know, 6-7 years ago, finished those up.
Yeah. So. Did you ever get your hands on an actual sardonyx to like compare it to yours?
No, but there's a really funny picture of, it was in Vintage Guitar Magazine a few years back. So Pat Smear has one of the Sleepwalkers and a friend of mine, another friend of mine was doing an article on the sardonyx. And so who's also a mutual friend, you know, with Pat. And so he got the two of them together and posed, you know, with Pat sitting between the two and holding them up. And so you can actually kind of see the two of them. And they're definitely, each one is its own thing, like between the Bunker, the sardonyx, and the Sleepwalker.
Yeah. Have you hung out with Dave Bunker much?
Quite a bit.
Yeah.
He's one of my heroes. And I recently interviewed him for the Experience Music Project and had a blast because... I'd always felt like, you know, he was brilliant and light years ahead of his time. And if you start looking at like his timeline and things that he invented back in the 60s, which others did very well with, you know, he didn't really like protect his patents.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his thing. You know, he was chasing this touch guitar, which was amazing in its own right. But he had to invent so many things along the way in order to do that, and things that, you know, like fine tuners and the headless guitar and all this stuff. And so again, you know, like he was so far ahead of the curve, and 100%, you know, like genius inventor, like not business person. So
nice.
Yeah.
Is there a bunker exhibit at EMP coming up or something?
I hope so. Yeah. You know, I know that they've got some really cool ones in the vaults, and I've got a few, and I think Dave's family has a few. So
yeah, we had him here with Deke Dickerson a while back. He's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So then what was the next model guitar?
So the next one was, I think I did an offset, which I call the DC-9.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, like growing up with a real love of the Jazzmaster and the Jaguar, but not really that excited about the hardware that was on that. Like mm-hmm. I was more of a Strat guy. I grew up playing Strats and working on those and liked the feel of that. And so I wanted to do an offset that was like a string through, like an old Telecaster, mm-hmm. and then maybe, you know, do just different pickups in it. Things of that nature. Then also, I think around that time I started coming up with this bizarre headstock idea where three of the tuners are, you know, conventional on one side, then the other, the treble side is more like a classical guitar where they feed through like that. And there were a lot of ideas, you know, behind that.
What were those ideas? Because that is an interesting headstock.
Part of it was like there's a love of asymmetry, you know, mm-hmm. so I really wanted to do something that was kind of unique in the headstock. But also with that too, I liked the idea of getting away from string trees because as a repair person and also a guitar tech, that, you know, string trees could be kind of a challenge and like a tuning issue. And mm-hmm. so here was a way to do a headstock that's not a tilt back. But so on this, like as the strings get thinner and specifically the plain strings, they start moving away like at an angle mm-hmm. and you get more downward pressure on the nut as the string actually gets smaller. So, that, you know, the idea was that that would translate into, better resonance and better sustain. So.
Mm-hmm. And did that headstock go through a couple iterations before, or did you kind of lock into one design for it?
Yeah, I think I monkeyed with it a little bit, but it was more just the overall outline, but the idea itself was there.
Yeah. So. And the offset guitar, did you limit yourself to a certain number of those too?
Yeah, I want to say that I probably did less than 20 of those too.
That's an overriding theme here.
Yeah. Well, and that would also too, like I've changed it a bit. I'm doing another version of it. And so I sort of thought, well, you know, then, so after that, I noticed like offsets became extremely sort of popular and like a lot of people were doing offsets and I felt sort of weird about like,
yeah.
You know, I kind of want to keep doing things that are not super contemporary, or at least that other people are doing.
Yeah.
So I was sort of, I guess, thinking about dropping it. And then I had this idea like, wow, it'd be, I suppose I just had this idea to do a zebra wood top guitar with binding on it. And anyway, it's like the new one that I'm doing. So I've resuscitated it and kind of revamped it and
but new wood.
Yeah.
Does the wood affect the sound much on this guitar?
Well, on this one I used swamp ash for the body, but I chose to go with the veneer for the zebra wood on top.
Yep.
And because I didn't really want to I didn't want to lose the sound of swamp ash.
Yeah.
So I went with more of a, you know, which zebra is more of really like a decorative wood. Using like a thicker piece, I recall from like my recollection, it was like one of those kind of oily woods. It's hard to glue. Yeah. So with the veneer, you can actually, you can, you know, wash a lot of that off to get really much better adhesion. So, yeah.
And then, you just came out with a pedal, or you've just sold a bunch of pedals. Mm-hmm. Describe what that was all about.
So that was, I built a number of pedals over the years, typically one-offs and had enjoyed doing that. And I think that, you know, it's kind of even almost similar to like the story of the Sardonyx. I developed a fascination with the Marshall Superfuzz, which was a pedal that was built in the late 60s. And it was kind of an offshoot of the Vox Tonebender mm-hmm. With a bit more low end. And the original examples that I was looking at were like, they were getting ridiculously like pricey. So I thought, well, I should just build my own. Yeah. And I thought, well, if you're going to build your own, why don't you just build a handful of them? Because knowing myself, if I build one, I'm going to devote a lot of time into trying to, you know, optimize this thing and sort of work with the circuit a little bit to figure out how to, you know, just be really happy with the results. So I think on a very kind of a casual Facebook post, I said, hey, I'm going to build 30 of these. And I built a prototype. And like within 4 hours, they were all swooped up. So I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now I actually have to build them.
You're in the pedal business. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're all done now, right?
Yeah, they're done. And so I'm back to guitars now. So.
All right. And do you have some new designs you're working on, or what are you up to?
Yeah, I've got I guess I have a stack of drawings that you're looking through. So whenever it's time to move on to the next one, there's that. So, yeah.
It's an interesting model. You don't really rest on your laurels much. You just kind of keep moving forward.
Yeah, I try to just keep it fun and have it not turn into that job that gets old or boring or...
Yeah. And you never did a Tele or a Strat?
No, and very intentionally stayed away from that because I noticed that a lot of builders were building Strats and Teles and...
Yeah.
And I thought that was cool, but, you know, but ultimately, I just kind of felt like it's been done, you know, yeah. I can understand the competition to build a better Strat or Tele, and there's a lot of theories about, you know, paint finishes and woods and routing and what they did, you know, this year to that, or maybe, you know, you can bring something to the table that's not offered, you know, by the bigger companies, but I just didn't see the point of it myself. I kind of wanted to do something that was maybe, I guess for lack of a better word, jaw-dropping. So,
mm-hmm. And you're guitar teching again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who are you going out on the road with?
I just started working for an artist named Brandy Carlisle,
sure.
Who's wonderful.
And I imagine the vibe on that tour is a little different than Nirvana or the Foo Fighters.
Very, yeah.
Yeah, a little more sane?
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
And what, when you're on the road with her, what are most of the needs besides restringing? I'm assuming restringing takes up a lot of, or tuning takes up a lot of your time, but.
Yeah, that's a bulk of it, but there's a lot of capo changes. So that's the one area where I stay busy is retuning for a lot of the songs are in different.
Yeah.
Different.
And what's your go-to tuner when you're doing these shows?
I'm a fan of the Peterson. I like that it's got the sweetened tunings, and I do have a rack mount one that I haven't taken out yet, but I think next year there's going to be some heavy touring that goes on. So with that, at least, you know, you can take more gear out and leave it in the road cases and stuff versus like trying to a lot of, right now we're doing a lot of one-offs. And so it's like, I don't really like to ship a lot of rack gear through the airlines. So.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know you got to hit the road tomorrow, so I'll let you go.
All right.
This was great.
Right on.